Hello, and thanks for listening to the Adulting is Easy podcast. This is your host, Lauren, and I have another Wealth Wednesday for you from this week. That's a live recording of a Twitter space from September 14th, 2022. We talked real estate. Tom gave us some updates. So did Steven and me and Clint. We also took audience questions as well. Stay tuned at the end for a kind of fun and exciting announcement from this squad. Hope you enjoy it.
So, Tom, what's been going on?
Ma'am.
How's your week been going?
My week has been, so we're halfway through. It's been going slow. I was actually just working on buying some countertops for my May house. And I just settled on faucets. I just settled on, so we're at the finish point. He's been working outside. We're about, I think we're $16,000 into the renovation, and we're at about 20. And we should finish up right on budget, depending on how everything else plays out over the next 2 weeks, because I've got the final finishes ordered. I've got all the lighting up. I've got all the painting done. I've got all the doors in. We replaced a bunch of the doors. Yeah, that's been my real estate endeavors so far today.
That's exciting. And it's on your own house, which must be kind of refreshing.
No, this is for a house that I bought in May. I bought it at the end of May. It was supposed to be done by the beginning of August, and it'll probably be done by the beginning of October. Just, we got pulled in several different directions. Oh, Tiffany's in here. We need to bring her up just to say hi to her.
I already invited her.
Okay, good. This was just a slow-moving project, and this is one that the city has been very picky about on everything. So, like, while we were at FinCon, I was like, texting with the landscaper, and I'm like, I will pay you extra. Can you just make it look all edged up, all blown, all, because they've been super particular about this property. And if you see all the other ones on the street, you would wonder why this one has become such a hot topic, because it's just, yeah. So it's looking good. We're really close. I'm excited that all the painting is done outside. The new light fixtures went up outside. So it's looking like a brand new house. Oh, yeah. I'm about to order the address numbers for it. And yeah, that's been my real estate endeavors so far this week.
Very cool. I am at one of my Airbnbs because my primary house rented out while we were at FinCon. And so on Sunday, we had to like pack up and move to one of our Airbnbs, which has been good. My husband has been putting up new blinds, and we're just like checking on different things with the cleaners and supplies and things like that. And it's on the water, which is kind of nice too. So that's how my real estate week is going. What about you, Steven? Are you still, you're still placing your, well, wait, let me say hi to Tiffany. Hey, Tiffany.
Hey, everyone. How are you?
Good.
I'm excited that you're here with us tonight.
Me too.
Aw, thank you. I love y'all.
It was nice to meet you in person, finally. Both of you, actually, for that matter.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's like FinCon is where you can meet all the people that you follow forever.
Yeah, exactly. This was my first one, so it was my first taste of it. Oh, yay, Paul's here. So, Steven, you've had a turnover at your rental, is that right?
That is correct. Yes, I had a turnover at my one and only rental property. I feel like such a noob when I'm in this weekly spaces with you guys, because I have one rental property and Tom has got 21. Lauren, you have 8 or 9. And anyways, but yeah, so that's what I was doing this week. I had a bunch of showings, and our market is really crazy here, so it was very easy to rent it out. And so I just have to deal with all the paperwork, signing the new lease agreement, and getting, I already have the deposit, so that's locked in, put in the bank, and then they're going to move in on the 25th. And so the previous tenant paid up until the end of September, and then the new tenant paid as of starting September 25th. So I get a bit of double rent there. A bit of time. Like, it took my entire weekend to get this thing showed and vet the tenant and try and pick the one and stuff like that. So I don't feel bad about it at all. But I always feel so insecure talking about rentals with you guys because it's like I'm showing up with like a little go-kart.
It makes you feel better.
I got my how many doors are you turning over today or this month, Tom?
I've got four by the end of the month that I have four total that I'm working on.
So only have four doors and they're all inherited. So I haven't even placed any of these people. Oh, Tom, I wanted to ask you about this. Guys, I promise we're going to get going here eventually, but we haven't talked in a little while. Tom, one of my tenants died this weekend.
Okay, so I'll share my experience with this because I've had it happen.
But she has a spouse who's still going to live there. I don't know if that matters.
And were they both on the lease?
Oh my God, Eric just heard me say that. I forgot to tell him. Sorry. Yes, they're both on the lease. Yep.
Okay, so I had where a tenant passed and her adult son lived with her. And he was basically, long story short, he ended up just staying and squatting. And it was quite a process trying to get him out. I ended up paying him to leave because he was not paying her. It would have been one thing if he just took over the rent, but he wasn't working regularly. And it was just a very tough transition to turn that place over. Because at that point, I didn't even have a tenant that was a non-paying tenant. I had someone that I didn't have a lease with squatting in my place. So it was a different procedure. So I ended up helping him get placed. I ended up helping him move. I didn't physically help him move, but I gave him money for the truck. And it worked itself out. But it was just, that was actually longer than a regular eviction in that case.
Yeah, I believe that. In this case, this woman, she's been bedridden for a long time. She was bedridden when we bought the place. And she had a stroke maybe a month ago, which this has actually been kind of interesting. So she's a long-term tenant in our 6-unit building. And her daughter has been coming to stay at the same building in our short-term rentals to take care of her on and off for the last month, which was, it was actually kind of cool that I think that, she could come visit her mom and stay in the same building. But unfortunately she did pass, but the husband is planning on staying for now. And so that was kind of hard. I had a tenant die one time before and they moved out. The spouse was still alive, but the son moved the mom in with him when the dad died.
So this took a really dark turn. Should we introduce Clint since he is here with us?
Yeah, Clint, have you had anybody die? No, I'm just kidding. Lighten the mood.
No tenant deaths ever that I'm aware of. We did have one move out last month, so we're in the same boat as Steven with one place currently being in the process of renting. So, not quite as much as Tom, and same as Steve. That's us. Pretty simple. Oh, wait. I had relevant, Lauren. I had my first call from a bank with respect to two of our mortgages that are variable rate. And so I think they may start to hit trigger rates, which means that the portion of your payment that is meant to cover the principal is no longer sufficient because the interest rate's chewing it up. And so they make the call to say, hey, we have to change your payment amount. So we don't think that's the case on these two. We think they're just going to ask us if we want to fix it, but that would be crazy. And so we'll figure that out. But we're probably getting close to trigger rates on three of our other loans.
So, Clint, does that mean when you say fix it, that means you fix the payment, but you pay less principal?
No, if we want to switch from a variable rate loan to a fixed rate loan.
Okay.
So and what would calling and saying, hey, your rates moved up and are you comfortable with this mm-hmm. rate or would you like to fix your interest rate? But given where interest rates are now, fixing the interest rate to a fixed rate loan would just be not a good idea in my mind. So we'll keep it variable.
So what is the interest rate going to be?
So that's a thing. It's not too bad because prime got moved in Canada, which is our borrowing rate. It was moved up to 5.45%. And we are at probably somewhere in the neighborhood on most of our debt at prime minus 1%. So we'll be at a rate of 4.45%.
Wow, that sounds pretty good down here in the States. Let me tell you. Let's see.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. I'm going back and forth on a $800,000 property, and it'll be a real nice. I think we're going to do adjustable, but it would be like 6% for 5 years. So it's looking kind of rough.
Yeah, I think what we've noticed between these conversations is we have better interest rates than you guys do down there, but we can't lock in for as long as you guys can. So generally the longest we can lock in a good interest rate is a 5-year term. Whereas you guys seem to be able to lock in at a slightly worse rate, but you can lock it in for 10 years, 20 years. It seems like ridiculously long amounts of time relative to what we can do.
And Clint, how does that impact stuff you have under contract that's being built right now? Is that stuff like locked now, or do you lock once it's built?
Well, as a developer, usually your loans are prime based. So you get hit pretty hard when the interest rates rise because you don't have an ability to lock in construction loans. So normally for most developers, your loans on your construction are floating. And so what you see happening for most developers, or many developers right now, I wouldn't say most, is you have a bit of a tsunami happening in that revenues were running up really hard, which was great. And at the same time, to get underway on a project, you have to have a certain amount of it pre-sold. So imagine if you're seeing a high-rise tower being built and it's a for-sale tower. You may have to have up to 65% of that tower sold. So you do that in advance. The revenues are going up, but you can't take advantage because you've already pre-sold. Then, because there's so much demand for construction, because things are selling so well, everybody wants to build at the same time, the cost of trades starts to go up because there's insufficient trades relative to the work being done. So the cost of your trades starts to go up exponentially. Pair that with inflation in all of your raw materials, and construction costs can be moving anywhere from 1-2% per month on a project. So if you're doing a project that had $100 million in costs, now you're up $1-2 million in costs. And then the third part of the tsunami, or the next, let's say the third and the fourth part, the third, revenues are starting to drop, which means you're bearing all these higher costs, but your revenues are now coming down. And then step four is the rising interest rates means that you're paying materially more to build these projects than you would have paid a year ago or 2 years ago. And so when you combine all four of those things, it's putting a lot of developers in rough spots, especially people who bought land within the last 12 months. So a lot of smaller, unestablished developers who may have been trying their first one or two projects, I think are in pretty decent dire straits. And there may be an opportunity for people who are well capitalized or developers that have significant free cash to, I don't want to say pick off, but to benefit from the poor planning and undercapitalization of some of the smaller developers. So it's the situation where a lot of large developers say this is where the dentists and the doctors get taken out of the real estate market. The people who are, you know, high earners and decide that they're going to build townhouse projects off the side of their dental desk, they get taken out in markets like this. So that's where I think we're starting to be right now. And we'll see it play out in the next 6 to 9 months.
Thanks, Clint. That's a really, really good breakdown. Of course, as a CFO of a development company, you certainly understand that, all of the kind of dynamics that are going on. And that's a good point about, you guys have lower interest rates, but they're fixed for only a handful of years, which I think would be very wild to people in the States, because I think a lot of times we take our fixed rate mortgages for granted, especially right now, anybody who's trying to get a mortgage right now. But what I've noticed, and Tom, I wonder if this is true for you in your markets of Dallas and Toledo, it seems like inventory has gone up. Offers have gone down. Competition is down. Tom, are you seeing that in your markets as well as I'm seeing that here in the Tampa Bay area?
Yeah, definitely. I was just working on a deal in Toledo, and stuff's still selling. We're hovering around 500 properties listed, which back in May, we were around 341. So good stuff is still selling, but what I'm seeing is, you know, one or two offers on a property versus, 12 or 14, which is what I was seeing in Dallas back in May. I'm also seeing, I don't know if you're seeing it in your market yet, but especially in Dallas, where people bought these properties to flip and they are sitting on them because the prices have shifted a little bit, the interest rates have shifted a little bit. So if it's not a solid, good house, and they cut corners, which flippers usually do cut corners, it's sitting and getting reduced and getting reduced and getting reduced. I kept tweeting about that last month where I was watching this house and they had 4 price reductions in 3 weeks, which is just crazy to kind of show all your cards. So that is what I am seeing here. I'm not seeing like home run deals, but I'm seeing more affordable. Like last week I was running a number on a Dallas property on a 4-bedroom. And even with the 6% and 7% interest, it was still making sense. It didn't have a ton of cash flow, but it was the right price, the right size, and the right amount of work. So it was priced correct for where we're at.
Have you ever flipped something, Tom, either on purpose or an accident?
So I've done 3 flips, and I actually made money all 3 times, but there was one in the mix, maybe like 2016, where I ended up making $1,500. And I was like, that was a whole lot of work for $1,500. And I could think of a million other things, like selling bras on eBay, that I'd rather do than do all the work that I did to that house. So my last flip, I ended up, my profit after tax and everything was $29,000. And I just remember when I got that money, I just said, I could have collected almost, I don't remember what it was. Maybe it was like $9,000 or $11,000 a month, or I'm sorry, a year in rent on this, or I could collect this one time $29,000. And it was in, I think that was 2018, where I'm just like, I'm going to stop doing everything for them just to make this one time $11,000. Because now even I saw that property that I bought it in the 20s, sold or put in like 11,000, and I think I sold it for around 70. I saw him flip it and he sold it for 140. So I put in a lot of work into that house for that 29,000. And where I'm at, where I'm in my late 30s, I would much rather collect, you know, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000, $11,000 over the next 10 years every year, as opposed to making the quick 29,000.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never flipped anything on purpose or an accident. Hey, everybody. This is Wealth Wednesday. By the way, I never did this. This will be on the Adulting is Easy podcast feed in a few days. Make sure you follow everybody that's on the panel. And if you have questions, I think we're open to them now. So if you want to make a request and ask one of us a question, we are here for that. Stephen, are you back with us?
I am, yes. Yeah. Sorry
okay,
about all
cool.
that. Yeah, I did. Technical difficulties. Yeah.
I'm good. How dare you? How can you have technical difficulties? Aren't you mining stuff over there? What happened?
That's part of the technical difficulties. They hog some of the, I don't know what you call it, bandwidth. They interfere with life over here, man. Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like, so what happens if you're in it? Like, what happens to those miners? Or I'm sorry, excuse me, the rigs. What happens to those if the internet goes down?
Yeah, they don't work anymore. They need internet. So you and I have kind of joked about this before too, about, you know, this whole movement of get rich and get off the grid. I kind of need the grid. So I don't have a choice. I need the grid in order to make some money. So, and you know, it's actually quite timely. The Ethereum, I know we're not talking about Ethereum and mining and stuff, but if you don't mind, I should have said, if you don't mind, that would have been awesome. They're moving to proof of stake tomorrow. The Ethereum countdown. I'm just looking it on Google right now.
Oh, I thought it was like next week. That's crazy.
No, it's tomorrow. It's like Christmas Day type of thing.
I don't know much about it, but it sounds like people are anticipating a cluster truck.
A cluster truck, yeah. In 5 hours and 8 minutes, the hard fork happens. So it's going to be arguably the biggest day in cryptocurrency mining, and definitely for Ethereum since Ethereum launched. And so, I mean, that'll happen at midnight tonight, my time. And it makes it so I can't mine Ethereum any longer. There will be a sharp decrease in the ability to mine it. Like, it won't be like a hard stop. It's all of a sudden done. It'll take about a day or two for it to kick in. But the forking happens tonight. It's going to be really cool to see it all unfold, and really excited for it. Ethereum's moving to proof of stake, and what that allows it to do is they're moving off of energy intensive mining equipment, and it'll open up incredible opportunities for Ethereum moving forward. Increased throughput, decreased energy usage, and they can compete with the likes of Visa and increase their utility and stuff. So anyways, I didn't want to be this a plug for Ethereum or anything like that, but just, you know, it's the biggest day of Ethereum's history, really, is happening in 5 hours. So pretty excited for that.
It's pretty cool.
When the internet goes down, I lose money. That's for sure.
So, like, say you're like, you're like your nodes, your stakes. I don't know that if you call it stakes, your nodes, your mining. Like, what happens to stuff that's like halfway done when your internet goes out or your power?
I love hearing someone who doesn't know much about cryptocurrency ask me questions, because it's like,
what they say about people, like, I could go to like Mexico and try to speak Spanish, and I think they appreciate you for trying. But if that's not the case in the crypto community, I will cut it off right now. I have no problem. I will never speak it again.
I have a feeling you're going to edit this entire section out of your podcast. It's okay. So what was the question, though? Because I got cringed and then I got put into a corner. What was the question?
So you put on all this processing power, and then you're like 99% of the way through your work. What happens? Like, you just lose it all and that's it? Too bad. Do you have to reboot and start over?
No. So it's more like every 6 minutes with the case. So I have a little cable box. I have shared it in our Discord service where it's like, hey, this is what an Ethereum node looks like. And that little thing, it literally looks like a cable box. It runs 24/7. It's very energy efficient. It literally is like a cable box. It's not much more than that. And it just does little validations against the Ethereum network. It runs a batch command every 6 minutes. And then once it completes that batch command or an epoch, then it gets a reward for it. So if it loses internet connection or power, then it would lose the next epoch. And so it would lose it for the next 6 minutes, the next 6 minutes, the next 6 minutes. And then it comes back online. Then it continues on where it left off. You don't lose any of the reward that you've earned, but you will get a penalty for every epoch that you miss. An epoch is just a block in the blockchain. Just think of it like, you know, as a group, we had a transaction that we needed to make. You missed out on it, so therefore you got a bit of a penalty, and then just decrement your account a little bit. So you have an incentive to be online. They need to give you an incentive to be online, and a disincentive if you go offline.
Tom, I saw your hand, but Brian requested first, so I want to go to Brian first.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for giving me the time, guys. So with all the sales prices, just, I know we're starting to see a lot more people talk about sales prices and real estate coming down. I wanted to ask you guys, if you guys had the crystal ball, how long do you think, you know, this is going to continue to keep dropping? Or is that even a question you can answer?
So I saw an article about the different areas that were dropping. And I live in the Tampa Bay Area, and that's not one of them. So I don't know it. My personal opinion is that we're not going to see like this cross country, or I don't know where you're based, Brian, cross the world drop kind of like we saw before. Go ahead, Clint. I know you're all over this.
Well, you nailed it, Lauren. There's no across the board answer. It's always geographic specific. Now, that said, you're going to want to look at a number of things. One, how soon do they get inflation under control? If inflation isn't under control in the short term, they're just going to continue to raise interest rates. As they continue to raise interest rates, the price of real estate will decline. It just makes sense. You can't afford as much home, so you can't buy it. So that's step one. Step two then becomes, what does that look like long term? How long do you think it will take before inflation's under control and or we trigger a recession? If we trigger a recession, then usually interest rates drop. The next half of the equation you want to look at in your geography is, what does the supply and demand look like? How many homes are built on average per year? How many people are moving into your geography? What's the economy like where you live? So when you factor that in, you can look at it and say, okay, with the rising interest rates and the lower prices, for example, where I live, most people who are doing high-rise projects are putting them on hold. So those will slowly stop. Almost anyone who is doing a rental project is no longer putting the rental project under construction, because when you look at the cost of acquiring, developing, and building that rental project relative to the interest rates you'll pay when it stabilizes, you're underwater. And so you look at it and say, okay, no one's building high rise. People aren't building rental projects. What are they building? And it's few and far between, maybe townhouses, because you can pace the construction and you don't have to have the pre-sales. So the amount of inventory that's being added is insufficient relative to the demand that's already there. So you fast forward and say, well, what does that mean for me? Well, it means potentially in the next 6 to 9 months, there could be very good buying opportunities. And in the next 3 to 5 years, I should be in a very good position on any real estate that I buy in the next year. Now, the challenge you have, and none of us have a crystal ball, is if I'm better off 3 to 5 years from now, and things will get worse in the next 6 to 9 months, where in that 6 to 9 month to three year mark is the bottom? And this is where the same issue with stocks comes in, because anyone who tells you when the bottom is on equities or when the bottom is on real estate, they are a guru who you never want to listen to, because none of us have that answer. But you're looking at potentially somewhere in that 6 to 9 month mark, bad, 3 to 5 years from now, good, depending on where you live again. And so where do you buy in there? And for me, I'd probably be comfortable buying anywhere in the next 9 to 12 months if I had sufficient capital on the sidelines to do it. That's the way I would look at that answer for real estate, is to say, I think there will be some sales on 9 months from now. And if I had sufficient capital available, then I would go on a buying spree. That's me.
Yeah, Clint, I tend to agree with you there. I think, Brian, there's less competition. I think we're seeing prices lower, at least some price drops, which I don't remember seeing very recently. And my personal philosophy and what I will be acting on is, I will buy places with the assumption that I wouldn't have been able to buy them a year ago because they would have been priced higher or there would have been more competition. and that I will be able to refinance in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, something like that. Tom, do you have thoughts and answer to Brian's question?
So I'm still buying, and I answer this question all the time. My first house that I bought in 2004, my interest rate was 6.875, and it made sense in 2004, and I was able to cash flow on that house. It was a duplex. I lived in one unit, rented out the other, and it fell dramatically in 08 and 09, and it probably got down to about 50,000, and I had bought it for 90,000. But it cash flowed every year, so I just held it. And then back by 2016, 2017, we were back at 90,000. So I'm still buying. I've bought 5 this year. I bought 1 in Dallas and 4 in Toledo. I am not actively trying to buy at this moment because I'm trying to get all my stuff rent ready like we were talking about at the beginning. But if the deal makes sense at the higher rate, I don't know. And you want control of the asset. That's the biggest part that people miss is putting a deal under contract. And I mean, I've bought a money pit. I've been there. You don't want to buy a money pit, but if it's a asset, like I tweeted about the commercial space that I bought back in 2019, it was a great good bones property that was pretty much a great deal because it was poorly listed. And I put $10,000 into each unit, and I made $31,000 last year in rent alone on this $65,000 commercial space. So again, me waiting on the sidelines because the interest rates higher would have made no sense back when I bought that property, and rates were a lot different back then, and I couldn't even get a loan on it because the retail space had not been rented for so long. So I had to do non-traditional financing. But if the asset and this is, Lauren, you were talking about that property that you have the offer out on down in Florida. It's a double lot. It makes sense. You want control of that asset now. So if it makes sense now and the rate's higher and you can refinance on the road, that's my stance. And that's why, you know, I've bought 5 this year. And I know Tiffany's got her hand up next.
Yep. Go ahead, Tiffany.
Yeah, I was just going to echo Tom and Clint. I mean, none of us truly know what's going to happen. Like, none of us could have predicted this 5 years ago, even, you know. So at the end of the day, my stance on it is if your finances can support it, and then that's one of your goals, then go ahead. Because at the end of the day, like Tom said, you can always refinance later on when rates go back down. So if this is one of your goals and you really want to do it, then, you know, Tom said he's been buying the whole time, you know? So none of us truly know what's going to happen. This would have never been predicted 5 years ago. I know I bought my house in 2017, never thought that it would be, double what I bought it for now. So we just never know. And I actually made a post about that. Like, none of these market, no market you can time. It's just a matter of getting in when you can get in and when your finances support it, and then just riding the wave and going with the flow from there.
Yeah, well said. Absolutely. And Stephen, as far as I know, you also purchased kind of before the big crash and held on all the way through it to now. Is that right?
Sorry. I held on. I bought before the crash and held on all the way through with real estate.
Yeah, with your with your condo.
Oh yeah, okay. So I completely mistimed that. So I bought my condo in 2004. I rode it all the way up through 2008, 2009, and I should have sold it before that. I rode it all the way down, and I've ridden it all the way back up. But the smart play would have been to have sold it in 2007 when it was double the price and stuff. So I'm horrible when it comes to market timing on real estate. I echo what Clint has said. Nobody knows where this is going. Even the paid professionals who are paid insane amounts of money to know where things are going and make, you know, interest rate decisions, economic decisions, even they are just, they're making the best guess they can, but there's a lot of lagging indicators and lagging data, and they try and course correct things as they go forward. So it's very, very difficult to know. And real estate really is localized to your market. So what could work in Tom's market of Toledo, Ohio, and Dallas, Texas may not work out the exact same with where Clint is in Vancouver and where I am in Calgary and where you are in Tampa. It just, they're all just a little bit different. Like the vacation dynamic, the economic dynamic of, you know, the jobs and the market that are there, the incomes that people have are all just a little different because so for example, with Calgary, Alberta, where I'm at, it's driven a lot by oil and gas. So as oil prices rise, incomes within the city will rise, job demand will rise, and it'll draw people in. And we are having a large influx of people from Vancouver and Toronto move into Calgary to take part of the boom in oil and gas again. And so that's having a really good positive effect on real estate prices and the rental market that we have here. So remember earlier we were talking about how I had no problem renting out my condo. Well, it's because people are moving in from Toronto, Vancouver. They sold their place. They're moving here and they're trying to take advantage of the arbitrage of I can sell my Toronto condo for 1.1, 1.2 million. I can come out here, rent for a little bit, buy a place for $200,000 or $300,000, and also have a terrific place that I can, or a terrific city that I can work at and make a good income. And then, but that dynamic doesn't play out everywhere. Like, that's not what's happening in Toledo, Ohio. And we're having a bit of a draw and pull from what is happening in Vancouver there, right? So we're people in Vancouver where Clint is, they might be selling a little more and then coming out here and buying a little more. So it really is individual to the city that you belong to and the interest rates and stuff. So some terrific points tonight, but that's what we're seeing here where I'm at.
Yeah, terrific points and a great question from Brian. Does that help in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of those points are really great. I'm new into the real estate industry, so I'm just trying to kind of be a sponge and soak it all up. And I kind of have another following question that emphasizes what you guys are talking about. Is I'm so timid to buy into markets that are away from me, that are farther than a couple hours drive. How do you guys confidently buy and manage properties out of state, and try to get over those hurdles that come with being at such a distance?
So I think I have to answer this one since I'm one of the only ones on the panel that buys out of state, but Paul is in here. Paul, he was on a space a few weeks ago and he's up in Canada and bought in Ohio. I'm down in Texas and I have been buying in Ohio since 2004. I went away when the prices were the same, and then I came back when the prices became so exorbitant that it didn't make sense to buy anything in Texas. My answer for you is your team makes or breaks you. And when I bought in Cleveland, I lost $22,000 because I had no systems and no team. Read the Bigger Pockets forums. They're there for that. I have skewered that. They're free. And don't be hesitant. Like, someone just asked me about property manager. And just recently, when I was looking for a property manager, instead of just going with the reviews, and these are great reviews, I went with the property that had, this guy has 60 doors, and he's been through almost all the management companies. And he straight up just said to me, I've been with these four. This is the best of the four. These are their shortcomings. And then I, with that knowledge, went to the management company that I now have up in Ohio and said, these are where I hear you're weak. Is this true? Are you doing any, you know, because my big thing buying in Ohio and being in Texas, and why I switched management companies back in February, was my company was doing the basics, but they were doing nothing extra. And then I saw the houses starting to fall apart and things that should have been caught on monthly inspections or quarterly inspections weren't. And I had a winter where it was the coldest day of the year up in Toledo, and I had two furnaces go out at two different houses because the inspection didn't get done back in August and no one followed up. to make sure that it got done. So here I am in the middle of January scrambling. I had to buy a new unit and pay extra to have it overnighted. So having that company that wasn't getting it done cost me extra money. So talking to the ones in your space that are doing it, that are bigger and that have been around for a while, has been what's worked for me. And I can tell you now, when I get pitched, like, why don't we go buy in Kentucky? Why don't we buy in, where was I looking? Pearl, Mississippi, or wherever I've been pitched before. I have my systems in place and they're really solid in Toledo and in Texas. So I know when I hand someone a check for $3,500, they're not going to ghost me, and I'm not going to be chasing someone for $3,500 for work that didn't get done. So I think that's the biggest step, and where I definitely misstepped when I bought in Cleveland. I bought there with no money, nothing to repair. It was just one of those that I was 23 years old and I wanted to buy another house. So I went and bought another house, and it was a bad purchase from start to finish. And I held on to it from 2005 to 2015, and I lost money on it every year. So getting your team in place even before you need it is one thing that I always tell people, even if you don't have rentals, but you know you want to buy in this market or that market. And don't bank on one person. Like, I can tell you in Toledo, I have a really strong plumber, but I struggle still to this day, 18 years later, with electricians. That's the one that took a check from me and ghosted. And then it's actually the opposite in Dallas, where I have a really good electrician and general contractor. But when I have plumbing issues, it's like hit or miss. So getting your team in place even before you need it is going to help you get a whole lot further than just trying to read the web forums. But that's where I started. So I knew even who I needed and what I needed. And now when I do deals in Ohio, I only go with a certain title company. I only go with a certain realtor. I only go with people that I know that can get it done, because I've had bad experiences over the 18 years where I've lost money because I tried to go with someone else or do something. And I know now in both states, if I'm closing, I'm closing with a certain title company because I know that they can get it done, and I feel good wiring them money and knowing that I'll own a house at the end of that transaction.
Yeah, awesome, Tom. And because you mentioned Paul's name, I did invite Paul up here. Paul, do you have anything to add to what Tom said about investing? I'm going to say out of state, but of course you're out of country because you're in Canada and you invested in Ohio.
No, I would just second what Tom said, that you really need to have your systems in place and people that you trust, because where I am in Northern Canada, if there's an issue with my property, I can't just leave and go check it out. Property management, timeliness, title company, it's so important that you trust those people and they can do what they say they're going to do. And with my purchase in Ohio, it's been great so far, and very happy. But I wouldn't go out into another market without getting the foundations and, like Tom said, in place first. Deal finder, property manager, and title company, so important.
Right. And you mentioned, I want to say last week, but it wasn't, because I was at FinCon last week, but David Green's book on investing out of state. Brian, you've probably heard of it, Bigger Pockets, but that's a great book for this from what I've heard. Great points, Tom. Steven, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I actually had a question for Paul and Brian. What are you looking for when you invest, in Paul's case, out of country, and in Brian's case, out of state? What would you be looking for? And what would give you confidence to do an out-of-state or out-of-country real estate deal?
So yeah. For me, what I was looking for was a stable market with job growth and a blue-collar area. I wasn't really interested in any of the fast-appreciating markets because I wasn't confident in knowing it. Like, I always think what goes up's got to come down. But I was happy with just the stable cash flow, reasonably purchased property in a job growing market. And if I can have a property manager there and a deal finder, that's the market that I want to be in.
And so, okay, so a property manager that you can trust and a deal finder. Can you explain to me what you mean by a deal finder? So is that someone boots on the ground looking for an attractive real estate deal for you?
That is correct. A deal finder can either be a real estate agent, what it's most commonly, a turnkey property company, which where I bought my property from. It could be a wholesaler. You could buy like Tom Buys off Craigslist and social media. So really could be anything. But you definitely have to be someone boots on the ground that understands the local market, that you trust, that can say, you know what, this is a property that I would buy and it's a good deal. And you got to do your due diligence on your own, but that is what you need to have.
One more question for you, then we'll turn it over to Brian. What management fee is competitive, or what are you willing to pay for management fee for that remote location?
So so when I analyze a deal, I always analyze at 10%. This current company charges 5, but I would pay up to as much as 10 just for the quality of work that they do.
Okay, sorry, one last thing and then we'll go to Brian. So 10% of the that's of the rent. So if I have a place charging out or renting out at $2,000, they're going to collect $2,000 up front from the tenant. They're going to manage the property for a month, and then they're going to remit to me or send to me $1,800 at the end of the month because they take a 10% fee. And then also, as I understand it, because I've never used a property management company before, but I also understand they would also subtract any fees or maintenance costs during that month as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. All property managements are different. My company charges $75 if they have to go on to the property and manage something. They also mark up any service calls by about 14%.
I don't think I've ever even heard of 5%. Like that seems low to me. When I had a property manager for one of my long-term rentals, because it was in kind of a bad area, he took 10%. But as far as I know, I don't think he marked up any of the calls or anything like that. So maybe it kind of comes out in the wash, but I haven't heard of that. Our friend Alan Corey, once he got to like 50 units, his property manager went down from like 10 to 8%. So I think that's an interesting number. But go ahead, Brian. I think Steven had a couple questions for you.
Yeah. Well, I'm only 21 years old. I've been in the real estate business like 3 years, and now officially today's my first month as a commercial leasing agent. So I don't have an answer to the question. I don't even have barely enough money to get rent done this week, but I'm trying to soak up every little piece of information I can from people like you guys here, so I can make my best purchases in the future. But yeah, unfortunately, I'm not the guy to ask that question to. But yeah,
no, and I appreciate that honesty, Brian. Thank you. So maybe I could put it to Tom then. What would you look for if you absolutely had to buy out of state? Let's say you're going to go to, well, you were looking at Houston, Texas. So that's far enough away out of Dallas that you can't use the same teams. What would you be looking for if you had to invest in Houston, Texas?
So, yeah, I just looked there last month with a client, and he sent 5 properties. I had one for our session. We went through those properties, and I would be looking for the magic number that works in Dallas, which is 3-2. And I would be looking.
Hold on. What do you mean by 3-2? What does 3-2 mean?
It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, you can do a 3-2 or a 3-2-2, which is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage. But yeah, so if I were going into Houston, I'd look for a 3-2-2 that made sense and cash flowed. When I did that session with that client, he had brought 5, I had brought 1. And by the end of the session, the one that I brought made the most cash, but he didn't like. So we narrowed it down to one property that he ultimately went through. And it's just a way to look at it. Today in the comments, I was explaining what the 1% rule is. So if I were in Houston, I'd be looking at 1%. So if I'm buying this house and it's $200,000, am I going to at least collect 1% of the value in rent each month? Which when we were looking at them, they were very close. So if I were to rent it, I'd look at that 1%. I'd also look at Houston has a lot of flood zones, so I would look at the neighborhoods. I would look at the grades, and even I do this in Toledo when I go around to different zip codes. You want to understand what's in that neighborhood, and is there growth? Is there a decline? Does it make sense to invest there or not? So if I'm in Houston, I lived there back in 2006 for like a few months. So I know a little bit about the neighborhoods, but I want to understand where my money is going to go the farthest and where there's growth and where it's rentable. Because one thing in Houston is you can live 20 minutes from downtown, but it'll take you over an hour to get into downtown. So just understanding the neighborhood as I go further into it. And then who am I going to have do this work? Who am I going to have manage this? Who are my tenants? And understanding that as well, because I get that quite often where people will buy doors to buy doors, but then if they're unrentable or undesirable, it doesn't make sense to buy a property.
I find a place that has 1% of the capital purchase price. Step me through how I find the property manager or the system to support it. And we're under the assumption here I'm not allowed to step. I can go there to see it before I buy it, but day to day and month to month, I'm not allowed to go there. That's one of the rules. And that's a constraint I'm putting on you. I have to have somebody else manage it for me.
Okay, so I have a client that just purchased in Toledo. He did go up and look at the property before he bought it, but he has not been back there since. So we have been using his management company, which came from word of mouth, which came from a realtor that I trusted. I have three different clients that have now bought up in Toledo, and all three have tried different management companies. And it does appear on paper right now that this company is going to be the best company for him. So anyways, we used his property inspection from when it went under contract. We handed that over to the management company. There were a couple of big ticket items, like a furnace was replaced and we had to stamp our approval on the furnace and air conditioning being replaced. So now all the repairs on the list got done, and that's exactly how I would do it with mine in a market that I'm not in. And now the property management put it up the day before. They put it up a little bit too high. So I think that's my biggest beef with them. They put it up for $925. And if it were my property, I would have put it right at $850 because I know it would rent quick at $850. And we're waiting for, we have three applications on it right now. We're waiting for the lease to be signed, but we're kind of waiting to see the turnaround from this management company. But I would structure my deal. So if I've gone down to Houston, I've picked out the property, I'd pick my management company, and I would do it exactly the same way with a word of mouth or someone that I trust. And I've already had it where when I was looking down there, I talked to my realtor up in Dallas who has an office down there, who works with the same company that does management down there. So I would probably go that direction and I would start getting my systems in place. And some of the pricing that he was getting back from the management company was cheaper than the pricing I was getting back from like one-on-one contractors. So they have a little bit of a hookup at times where he was able to like dry lock his whole basement for $350. And when we were quoting it out, it was around $500.
Good point, Tom. Okay, let's see. I think it was I am Ari first.
Calling from South Africa, and I do have properties here and also in Nigeria. So I had somebody asking about how to find a deal, how to find a good deal. I just want to share a few examples of what I use here and also in Nigeria. The number one thing I use is to rely on agents. You know, I have good relationship with many agents, and because I have been good and kind to them, whenever they would deal, the very first person I believe they would call is me. So each time they bring a good deal, apart from their normal commission and whatever it is that they are to get, I make sure that, you know what, I give them something extra. And that way they know that they will always get the most from me, so they always come. So it's the rule. Whenever people know that they will make the most of money from you, they would do their best to make sure that, you know what, they do business with you. The number two thing that I always do is to, you know, dare people and say, hey, do you mind selling? And how do you find those houses that you would know? You know, like when you drive around and, for example, you know, eyebrow areas, suburbs, and you look at the buildings, almost all the buildings, we have 10 buildings, and none of it are well kept, well looked after. And there is one particular one that is not well looked after. You can just dare and check, hey, how are you doing? I'm looking for a house to buy. You know, I don't know if, you know, you are interested. It's either a yes or no. And I tell you, it works. It works. You would find people that would say, you know what, yeah, we're living, we're traveling, and, you know, you really want to buy? Okay. I'll need to talk to my husband, or I'll need to talk to my wife, stuff like that. And they do talk and get back. Another thing is, once people know that you are really deep into real estate, now that's the number three thing, position yourself to the extent that you become a solutionist to any real estate issue. And once anybody know that, you know what, you are their guy when it comes to real estate, if they are thinking of buying, they will come to you direct. You don't have to be an agent. You know, you don't have to. You don't have to be a broker. You don't have to. They will come to you and say, you know what, I am thinking of selling. I am thinking, what do you think I should do? Where? How much do you think I can get? What processes do you think I should do so that I can get a good deal for my house? And I promise you, it works. It works. So I don't know how it operates in the particular location that you are, but I want to challenge you to position yourself, let people know what you are doing, and try to solve their problems by making sure that, you know what, people around you know what you are doing.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ari, so much for saying that. I know Tom has done that before, given business cards and gotten calls back. Thank you so much for sharing that. Paul, I saw your hand, and then we'll go to Ten Dinashi.
Hi. Thank you, Lauren, for your space. And thank you, all you guys who are contributing. I'm a newbie when it comes to property investment. I just have got one quick question. I'm coming from Australia, here in Sydney. So my question is, what percentage of yield can I say it's a good buy as a property investment? In Australia, the yield roughly is about 5% or so. I've stayed in South Africa for the past few years before I moved here, and the yield in South Africa is a bit higher, but I just want to hear what figure I can work on that I can say, oh, I've hit a good deal here. Thank you.
Go ahead, Clint.
This is another question that's very geographic specific. So when you look at certain states or even countries, you'll have different yields. And this is something we talk a lot about on the show, because when you look at Tom's investments as an example, and he's talking about earlier the 1% rule, that implies a very good yield. And that's not the type of yield that you're going to get in every state. And Tom doesn't even, you know, Tom, I don't believe you get that in every state. You get it in Ohio. In Dallas, you might not. In Austin, you probably wouldn't. And so you have to understand, what are you investing for? And that's why when I tweeted out this space, I said three things. One, principal pay down. Two, your cash flow. And three, your property appreciation. So depending on what province or state you're in and what your long-term goals are, you may be comfortable taking a lower yield to get higher appreciation. And what I like to compare that to is equities and looking at, for example, FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Alphabet. And when you look at those, you are buying appreciation. You're not getting a dividend, you're not getting cash flow, but you're getting appreciation. When you look then at blue chip stocks, you're getting some appreciation with a decent dividend. That's a different yield classification. And then you look at pure dividend stocks, or you might even say junk bonds, and that's where you're going pure cash flow. You're getting a great yield, but you're not getting the appreciation. Now, that's not to say you won't get appreciation, but you're not banking on it. And so generally, when you look at bigger pockets, they always focus on cash flow. And it's in periods like this where, let's say, real estate prices are down 15% in Vancouver. Well, holy crow, if you were betting on appreciation, you got killed. You bought that $1 million townhouse and now it's worth $850,000. That's going to take a lot of time to make up. But if you're in Ohio and you bought a townhouse for $80,000 and you're renting it out for $2,000 a month or $1,500 a month, you're cash flowing even when the market goes down. And so that's generally why a lot of real estate investors say always focus on the cash flow. What they're also ignoring in that statement is generally your higher yield or cap rate for those who are in real estate. It comes with higher risk of vacancy. So if you're here in Vancouver and you have that townhouse, sure, it might have dropped in value by that much on paper in the short term, but you're almost never going to have an issue finding a tenant. The problem in some of those areas where they have the high yields is when you lose your tenant, you may not be able to replace them. So that is a very long answer to your simple yield you should be looking for, because Tom looks for high yields. My properties don't yield. So it's a very, very different question depending on what you're buying for, where your location is, and what your long-term goals are. Some people may actually choose a totally different metric altogether and say, I'm going to look at the IRR of my project or the cash on cash return or the cash on cash with principal pay down. I usually personally look at cash on cash with principal pay down or IRR, because if I looked at any of the metrics you would normally look at, I would never have bought any real estate in the city I live in. It wouldn't have made any sense. Tom, I'll pass it over to you on your thoughts, because I know you're a high yield buyer, and then Lauren, interested in what you think.
No, I echo everything that you said, and I completely agree with you on that. I don't have anything to add on this.
Awesome. All right. It is about 10:08. Does anybody have any other questions? We got a request from Godwin.
Hey there. I'm Godwin. I'm fairly new to the real estate game. My first property was, I bought it in 2019. After I came back from overseas, I'm an Army veteran. And we just did a refinance on it, because when I bought it in 2019, we used to run our family business at the property, but we ended up buying it from our landlord at the time. And then I was only making $30,000 a year at the time. Like, I was a young private in the Army. So the seller, it was actually, he actually co-signed on the loan, and then we just recently refinanced it. I tried to do a cash out refinance on it, but the bank at the time, it's Bank of OZK, my loan officer over there, I have a good relationship with her, but at the time she said she was not able to approve my cash out refinance request. We bought the property for $160 back in July of 2019, and right now we just got we got the appraisal done on it when we did the refinance a couple months ago, and it came back at $380. So she didn't really give me a clear description of like why the pre-approve or the refinance didn't go through. One of the points that she did mention was They did want to see me and my tenants have a longer lease term contract. Right now they're on a 3-year contract, but they've been great tenants, and we're already in talks of a long-term contract. But I just wanted to hear y'all's input on refinancing commercial property, because it is commercial property. So just wanted to hear some insight on if anyone else is experiencing refinancing a commercial property and how it went by. Thank you.
Is it okay if I share? So I have not hit my refinance on my commercial property yet. I believe I have 2 more years, but these 2 doors on this commercial space are joint with partners and what we have decided to do, because we know that it will be significantly higher, is we are just funneling all the profits right into the payment right now. So we should have this commercial space paid off right when it's time to refinance. And that was our way of avoiding it. We have also looked at, if we aren't able to hit that and we do want to take profits, maybe we try and do a portfolio loan where we package this commercial space and we buy a door or two, and we use the equity in this commercial space as our down payment on the additional doors. But again, we have not hit that where we have done it. So I know that that does not apply to you because you're in the process of doing that. But that's what I'm doing with mine right now, because I will, in I think it's 2 years in November, I will be in the same spot as you, where I'm going to have to, it was a 5-year term and I had to do a refi on it.
I'm just going to weigh in here. Goodwin, I just don't feel bad about your refi not going through. I just had this similar thing happen to me this week. I would try a different lender, because every lender, it's very different from their standards from property to property, and the rates and everything is vastly different. So that's why it's always a really good idea to shop around. So I would try a different lender and start there first. And thank you for your service.
Hey, Goodwin, also, when we were getting this, we got told no from one lender. And then on the exact same day, we had another credit union tell us yes. So I piggyback off of what Paul's saying. Do you have other options to look at other lenders?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We do have other options, or I do have other options to look at different lenders. My only thing right now is... our balance on that property after this refinance is $110,000. So I'm on the fence if I want to refinance or if I just want to pay it off. And then, cause it's cash flowing a lot of money per month. So our tenants are great people, are great tenants. So I'm on the fence of if I want to pursue another refinance at the time. But I do currently, I'm leaning towards refinancing, going towards another, like a credit union or a bank, just because I do want to purchase another property. My 9-to-5 could definitely fund it, but as far as like my timeline that I want to, I think refinancing right now with another lender is probably my best outlet. But I definitely appreciate you guys giving me some input on that.
All right. Hey, Bindlock, how's it going? Hey, David. Hey, Dr. Drew. Does anybody else have? Oh no, there's another one. Hey, Tim, you have the floor.
Hey guys, first and foremost, happy Wednesday to you guys. I'm Timothy Ori here. I'm actually a real estate agent in the state of Mississippi. I've been in real estate for about 4 years. I'm definitely glad to be a part of this group and join in with you guys on this Real Estate Wednesday talk. So the question I have for everyone is, I've done some flips, but I haven't set up some residual income. So next year, hopefully this year, if the right opportunity comes about, I look forward to getting a rental property. But I wanted to get your feedback on going single family or going a duplex or multi. We don't have too many multi units here in Mississippi, and if so, they're in more disfranchised areas. So I wanted to get you guys feedback on your opinion on where do you think I should start, either with a single family residential or just waiting for the right opportunity with a duplex or a quad.
I have 3 properties. That includes 12 doors, 8 short-term rentals, 4 long-term rentals. Not one of those is single family. So I said that to say I'm incredibly biased. So go ahead, Tom.
So right now, I'm an offshoot, but I am only focused on buying single family. And part of it is, now that I am retired, my problems generally come from my multifamily. It's always tenants fighting with each other, and it's my single families that I own in Dallas and in Toledo are just like quiet, well-kept. I'm never fighting with anyone at these properties. So I'm focused on single family. And I had a client and I looked in Mississippi and there were some really affordable single family properties. So I don't know exactly what market you're in, but if it's around where he was looking, we were looking at $30,000 and $40,000 houses, and you know, and a $40,000 house that needed $10,000 worth of work, but he could rent it for $750, $850. So it made sense all day long. So if you're looking in a very affordable area like that, then it would totally make sense to go single family. If you are in a much higher pocket of Mississippi, then maybe the multifamily made sense. I try and stress to everyone that I started in real estate at 21. I started making money on door number 5, which I think at that point I was 27 or 28, maybe even, no, I was probably 28. And what it was I bought some stuff early on and then I bought a money pit. So I went into it without a plan. So if you bought a $30,000 or $40,000 single family, and you understand your numbers and you understand repairs and you can make it cash flow, I would go that route. And it's just from 18 years of doing this, my multifamilies, it's not that they're bad properties. It's just that when you have people attached to each other, it comes with bigger issues. And that's just, again, where I'm at with this. I'd rather not fight with someone over someone playing music loud at night.
Is it okay if I have a follow-up question regarding your last statement?
Absolutely.
So I personally would like to go the single family route, and I'm in the Jackson area. Certain parts of Jackson, contingent on where you're located, you can get those properties for $30,000 to $40,000. Longevity wise, with you being an expert and being 19 years in, even in some disenfranchised areas where I may be able to acquire a property for $30,000 or $40,000 and maybe get, you know, $800 to $900 worth of rent. Longevity wise, is it better for me to invest in a disenfranchised area where I may have some issues with rent and the longevity of the property? Or is it better for me to invest in an area where 5 or 7 years from now, I still can maintain the value of the rent, and I'll have less issues with dealing with the tenant in the neighborhood too? That's kind of another area where I'm touring in as well too.
So I'm also focused on certain zip codes, and this really is for Toledo, but I would rather the longevity where you're not having as much problems. And as I keep going through this, I do have one D-class property in Ohio, and it's actually it's crazy because whenever I talk about selling anything, it's one of my favorites, and I always put it in my top 3 favorites. And it's really one of my favorites because it's just well-kept and I have a good tenant. But in general, I don't want to buy in that neighborhood. And I would much rather spend a little bit extra money where I know people are going to want to rent than to just buy a door to buy a door. And that's where some people mess up. And that's where I've messed up before. I bought a crack house on eBay. I knew the zip code. I didn't know the street. And it had fresh bullet holes in it. And it was a problem from the first day I owned it till the day I signed the paperwork to sell it. And I did end up in the green on that one. And it worked itself out, and it was one of the nicest ones on the block. But I should not have just bought a property to buy a property. And that's, I mean, I just got asked this question yesterday in an interview. I was sitting at work, and I started bidding on it on a Thursday morning. And by like Thursday at 3 o'clock, I owned it. And then by like 5 o'clock, I had my friend in town drive by it. And she's like, you don't want this one. And I'm like, I already own it. Like, I've won the bid. I'm going to be out 2,500. So I went through and I did it. So yeah, if you can spend a little bit more to get a property in a little bit better area where you're not going to have to chase rent, that would be the route that I would go. And that's where I'm at. And that's what I focus on, is I would rather get it in a nicer neighborhood and pay more for it, because I know people want to rent it, than get something further out. And I'm going to have to fight for rent every month.
Perfect. Thank you guys so much. I greatly appreciate this information. And I look forward to joining you guys on more conversation about real estate.
Thanks for joining us, Tim. And great points, Tom. I think now is probably a good time to wrap. Tom, Clint, you good with that? Yep, Tom's clapping. All right. Everybody, this has been another edition of Wealth Wednesday. We started in October of last year. It's now September, but doing this for about 11 months straight. It's always Stephen Wealthy, Clint Murphy, Tom the Frugal Gay, myself, Lauren at Adulting is Easy. Please also give all the speakers like Paul and Godwin, Tim, Tiffany, give everybody a follow. This will be on the Adulting is Easy podcast feed in a few days once I download it and edit it. Thank you guys for being with us every week. We love you so much, and we will see you soon. Bye.
Hey guys, thanks for sticking to the end. I wanted to tell you about Cashflow University. This is a new community that a bunch of us are putting together. There's about 20 to 30 experts, mostly from Money Twitter, that teach you how to generate cash flow. So the topics include real estate, which of course me and Tom are going to be key in. There's also personal finance, general topics, side hustles. Again, Tom's going to help us there with eBay flipping. Steven's working on Turo. There's also stocks. There's a ton of different ways you can generate cash flow in Cashflow University. We are going to be teaching you how. If you would like to join, I'm going to go ahead and put a link in the show notes as well. Feel free to DM Steven, me, Tom, or any of the Cashflow University teachers. Looking forward to seeing you in there.